This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
To me, it's not a failure. If we look at about what happened in the industry, we've been hearing projects of potential breakaway leagues ever since I was probably a teenager. Last year, it was the first time that not
Andrea Agnelli was in London earlier this year in late winter. He spoke publicly in the English capital for the first time since the Super League came apart at the seams, and remarkably, he flatly refused to accept that the project had been a failure. We know the drill for prominent public figures in all walks of life today. Never apologise, never explain. This was beyond that, though, a denial of what we'd all seen with our own eyes and heard with our own ears. It never was quite unanimous. Germany and France's big boys weren't keen, and one giant in particular actually did quite well out of the ESL's spectacular crash and burn. Yet Agnelli and Florentino Perez are still bold in fighting their corner, and their lawyers are still working. So what next? Is this story going to end in fans' forums, in the boardroom, or in the courtroom? And what does football really mean to us in 2022, 12 months on? This is the third and final part of Back from the Brink.
I think when you look at the precedents of the European Court of Justice, especially the European Court of First Instance, practices of European Commission, old English court decisions, then it's quite clear that it will be in favour of the Super League.
In the coming months, the European Court of Justice is due to decide whether the Super League is protected by EU law and, by extension, whether UEFA have an unfair monopoly over European football. It will be hugely significant, and Mark Ort only sees it going one way. Mark is a leading sports competition lawyer. He was keen to stress that his work involves fighting against these federations, like UEFA or FIFA, on behalf of athletes and other parties. Back in episode 1, we mentioned the 1998 Super League attempt, where Italian group Media Partners offered top European clubs €750 million. Although it never got off the ground, Mark argued that this competition actually forced UEFA to improve their own product. To suppress that competition would be unlawful.
And it became quite clear with the discussion of the European Commission, because there was a European Commission case, that such threats of a monopolistic organization which threatens anyone who wants to take part in another competition is, plainly speaking, an abuse of a dominant position and therefore prohibited. And to be honest, it was not so interesting for the fans. They did not have that such high income from TV money, because people were not really interested in watching Champions League games. Their national leagues had much, much more interest with the fans than the European games by that time. And Media Partner gave some incentive for the clubs. I mean, clearly speaking, the idea behind was that clubs should earn more money. But the idea was also to make the European games more interesting for fans, and in order to get more audience and sure to get more money, and the share of the clubs should be higher. And a number of the points proposed by that project, Gandalf, Media Partner International, however you want to call it, was later put into reality by UEFA. So they needed that input from a competitor or potential competitor, how we call it, and then they improved their product, because by now and after that, they introduced a lot of changes, and European Champions League became much more interesting for fans to watch, much more audience, and the games became much more interesting in the afterwards. So that potential competition was, in the end, very productive for the whole product.
UEFA aren't blind to clubs' ambitions, even if the timing of the Super League's announcement did take them by surprise. They've generally been well prepared for such events in the past. This time, maybe not so much.
UEFA has had a perfect competition lawyer, one of the best, maybe the best competition lawyer, Alistair Bell. I think he's now working for FIFA, but they are quite aware of the risks involved in competition law, and that is what I've seen from a number of cases, that they are quite aware that competition law is different to a number of other legal fields. And when I looked at what UEFA representatives' statements were short after and before the Super League, I didn't get the impression that they had been nicely prepared for that.
There were like heroic figures that emerged for that moment, but these aren't heroes, I don't think. Like, you know, I think UEFA got a lot of credit for what it did, but again, there's searching questions of UEFA to be asked.
Here's Tariq Panja, a journalist with the New York Times who helped break the Super League story. When we spoke to him, it was clear he felt something needs to change at the very top to stop clubs feeling like this would be a possibility in the future.
These are the people who are the trustees, the people who look after the stewards of the game, right? So that, what have they done that have created a situation where this type of thing is possible? What can be done in order for this not to happen as well? Are they looking after the game correctly?
The reaction was strong, was decisive. And as a fan organisation...
Ronan Evan, Executive Director of Football Supporters Europe, is familiar with UEFA's workings as much as anyone. He and others met with Alexander Čeferin in the days after the Super League announcement, and in the throes of crisis, there really was meaningful dialogue.
But we don't want less UEFA, we want more powerful, a stronger UEFA that plays its role as regulator within the game, taking into account the opinions and interests of every stakeholder.
But 12 months on, is Ronan still satisfied?
UEFA kept their word in the sense that we are increasingly consulted and included into operations and decisions that have to do with the way fans experience the game, and that's progress. There's also a better acknowledgement of fans' rights in general, and our right to attend a match in a safe and welcoming environment, and to have our rights respected. So there is certainly progress there. Nevertheless, there's still some work to do in terms of addressing the structural issues that led to the launch of the Super League, which is a number of clubs are too powerful. They have too much power within European football, and UEFA, in our opinion, at this stage, still hasn't addressed properly the lack of competitive balance within the games.
Chers supporters, c'est l'une des icônes mondiales, l'un des plus grands joueurs de l'histoire du football, qui nous fait l'honneur de revêtir le maillot parisien.
If there's a club symbolic of football's modern excesses and successes, as well as occasionally eliciting the schadenfreude of others, is Paris Saint-Germain. It might not have done so at the time, but Qatar's takeover of the club in 2011 is now prompting questions about football's obsession with money, no matter where it's coming from. Surely a club dripping with the spoils of excess would have jumped at the chance of guaranteed billions and box office fixtures.
Certain cynics or critics of PSG probably would have expected them to have grabbed the Super League opportunity with both hands.
Or perhaps not. This is Jonathan Johnson, French football correspondent for CBS Sports. He explains that PSG's willingness to endear themselves to the current powers that be was an even bigger attraction than the prospect of a Super League.
PSG, after their early tangles with UEFA, certainly over financial fair play, have become more savvy legally to the realities and the ramifications of these sorts of major changes. And I think they saw the opportunity to strengthen their hand within UEFA so that they are not made to feel sort of, almost like as a lesser part of European football going forward. Because up until then, there was definitely a feeling that PSG was sort of in that second bracket, the ones that were not necessarily put first, but were then considered afterwards. And I think that the feeling is that, playing the Super League crisis the way that they did, certainly brought them out in a much better, much more favourable, much stronger position, something that they didn't expect to present itself even sort of a week, 10 days before it actually happened.
PSG are already comfortably the biggest club in Ligue 1. They've won 7 of the last 9 French titles. And their domestic titles are sometimes treated as an underwhelming detail, far behind the ultimate aim of the Champions League. But they're not immune to the problems of football post-pandemic. Maybe they need strong competitors after all.
Obviously PSG, are sort of in their own world, with regards to the rest of their domestic competitors. But that's not to say that PSG weren't impacted by COVID-19 and the absolutely catastrophic handling of the Media Pro TV rights deal by the LFP. Now, that has created a lot of financial pressure on French football as a whole, as a collective. And we're only seeing that be addressed now. We've got CBC, who obviously have already got that deal in place with La Liga, who are also going to be entering into the Ligue 1 sphere, or the Ligue 1 and Ligue 2 spheres, because it's under the LFP umbrella, which means all of the professional clubs within France. So there is quite clearly, some sort of financial pressure there, certainly for PSG in a season like this, where they've dropped out of the Champions League early. So there's a bit of a shortfall in the money that they expected to come in. It's vital for PSG that they have some of these rivals, and that these rivals, are regularly playing to the best of their ability, because we saw Monaco beaten to the title back in 2016-17. We've seen Marseille flirt with potentially being title contenders and getting themselves back in the Champions League. But until these big established squads, clubs are capable of juggling the domestic and continental duties and, giving PSG a strong run for their money, it's going to be difficult to sell Ligue 1 as a more attractive league than their top five rivals without the star power that PSG boast, with your Messis, with your Neymars, with your Mbappes. There is also a school of thought in France that, you know, we might see PSG's owners' thinking change on the Super League should there be a proposal made after the World Cup at the end of this year. We'll have to wait and see what happens on that front. There's also the interesting subplot with part of this restructuring of French football that you know, beIN Sport and Canal Plus will be in court later this year, you know, to hash out the final details over what happened, you know, when COVID hit just before Media Pro came into play, and you know, should beIN suddenly vacate the market, you know, then that obviously leaves fewer ties for PSG's owners to consider, you know, if a more solid Super League proposal is made in the future.
Across the border in Germany, there is, of course, another giant of European football whose absence from the European Super League project presented a gaping rift in it from the start. Bayern Munich announced their rebuttal from the get-go. But their and Dortmund's circumstances are very different to Paris Saint-Germain's. The Bundesliga's 50-plus-1 model is the first obstacle. As the dust settled on the Super League in England, this model was held up as the panacea for the greed that had reared its ugly head. But the reality, it's not as simple as that. Here's German football journalist Stefan Ertzfeld. In the 60th minute,
the German model is still solid, not pretty solid. Well, we have those four clubs acting outside the famous 50-plus-1 rule, which means the club will have to hold more than 50% of the shares of the club. We have Hoffenheim, we have Bayer Leverkusen, VfL Wolfsburg and Leipzig. So the 50-plus-1 is no longer the main thing in German football. But what we still have is we are a community-based system, whereas even a super club like Bayern Munich, they have offices in New York, they have offices in Asia, they still know that they will only be able to function if they keep the fan base in their home city. So the ultras you would see on the stands at the Allianz Arena are the heart of the club.
And they make their voices heard. Last March, Bayern's fan group Club Number 12 joined forces with Dortmund's supporters organisation. They demanded that clubs not competing in Europe receive 50% of revenue from the three competitions. Under UEFA's latest reforms, this so-called solidarity pot is just 4%. These are fans who care about the sustainability of the game, sometimes over and above their own club's interests. Stefan also points out that you just need to look at Bayern's board as well. Last summer, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who played at Bayern for a decade in the 70s and 80s, retired as CEO and handed the reins to who? Oliver Kahn, the legendary Bayern goalkeeper who was between the sticks for the club for 14 years. These are people who've been inside the club for generations and who won Bundesliga titles and European Cups. Even if their members couldn't stop them, their principals would. Of course, all of this should come with the caveat that things can change. Bayern have explored joining a Super League in the past. Some are continuing to fight its cause more openly. The most significant of those is Juventus president Andrea Agnelli. To get more insight into the perception of him in his native league and country, I went for a walk near our studios in North London with Italian football expert and member of this parish, Nicky Bandini.
So, Nicky, how has the image of Andrea Agnelli changed, if at all, since he's been so prominent in the European Super League project?
Italy's football politics have always been complicated and have always been fractious and have always had warring factions. And I think you would have said before all this kicked off, for instance, that you had different power bases and Guardiola Tito at Lazio is sort of his own power base and generally at war with everyone. And sure, this might be another reason he's got now to point at Agnelli and say, you did this, why do I have to listen to you? But it's not like that's new necessarily. Everyone who isn't Juventus has always enjoyed Juventus failing. That's something that's been there forever, and well, certainly for decades and decades and decades. And Agnelli's just in some regards sort of the latest face of that.
What has been very important about the proposal that has been put on the table is that it has made everybody engage that there is a requirement for change.
And he's dragged them up the Deloitte Money League to sort of around the 9th or 10th spot in Europe. And that's the biggest club in Italy, you know, so that's something you think, gosh, it's only 9th or 10th in Europe, but that's where he got them to. And he's found this hard ceiling of the limits of what he can do. And he, from that, has drawn the conclusion that the only way to make things better is to create this European Super League that guarantees that there will be clubs in countries outside of, I mean, bluntly, it's outside of England, where the Premier League revenues have come up so much that it's very hard for clubs in other countries to compete. Sure, PSG can get impossibly wealthy owners, and that can fix the problem for them. But in terms of actual revenue, it's organic revenue that isn't just provided by a sponsor who happens to be part of the state that you represent. It's very hard for clubs to compete with the Premier League now.
From Agnelli's perspective, is part of it, we can talk about the limitations, as you talked about it, in terms of what there is in the domestic market. And it's definitely something that Bayern, a club that have been often compared with Juventus in terms of the European stature, have often been compared. Do we think that the natural ceiling is a huge part of what's motivated that? Or is there some sort of recognition, either from Agnelli and Juventus or from elsewhere in Italy, that some of those are self-imposed restrictions? Like they chose to make the Juventus Stadium the size that it is rather than bigger, for example. And that thing that we're talking about the contracts, because they do have a horrendous wage bill and they've struggled to effectively rebuild in the last 5 years because of that.
Yeah, Juventus have made some very poor decisions, I think, in the last 2 or 3 years when it comes to recruitment and player wages. I think that's undeniable. I don't think that you can fully separate one from the other. The hard ceiling is there, and I think it's interesting that Bayern have the same issue but also didn't come to the conclusion that the Super League was necessarily the answer to all their problems. I think that what is sort of interesting, actually, when you talked about Schadenfreude before and whether other people in Italy sort of are enjoying that Agnelli got this so wrong, I think, again, I don't want to be an Agnelli apologist because I completely disagree with his conclusions, but I think if you want to be sort of trying to see Agnelli's perspective, you can also listen to other things he's said in the last few years about how he wanted to see Roma and Milan and Inter, and Rome particularly, when they were trying to build a stadium, he wanted to see them succeed, he wanted to see them come up because he wanted the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah.
And I think he genuinely has wanted that for Italian football, for other clubs to do what Juventus did, to get their own stadium, to get their houses in order, to make decisions that allowed them to become more profitable, because that would help everyone within the context. And I do think that part of this Super League project is a frustration with not just Italian sporting culture, frankly, but Italian governmental culture and political culture that stops a lot of these projects getting done, and wanting to be able to sort of almost remove himself and his club from that context a little bit. That doesn't mean that the solution is not extraordinarily arrogant, because I think it is, and I think it's wrong, but I think that that is nevertheless a genuine motivation. I don't think that that is sort of false.
For Agnelli, then, it was a mixture of pride, money, a capitalist two fingers up to Italy's political class. Barcelona's motive is more obvious, plain desperation in the face of financial catastrophe. And what about Real Madrid?
Real Madrid is a different animal. It sees itself as in a league of one globally. There is nothing. It's Real Madrid, and that's football, as far as they're concerned. There is this privacy they have, this feeling of superiority that Real Madrid is. If they could play themselves every week, they would love that, probably, because there is a certain haughtiness to Real Madrid.
But the question I keep coming back to is, why would the Premier League clubs like Manchester City, for example, with their existing financial advantages, get involved?
Here's Melissa Reddy again.
The Premier League clubs have been so annoyed at Barcelona and Real Madrid for, you know, picking off their best players and for creating basically their own market in its own and their own, like Barcelona in terms of tourism and, you know, like their stadium tour and stuff, used to absolutely rake in cash that even United, as gigantic as they are, could never dream of. And the Premier League clubs have been waiting to kick those two. And then when they're finally on their knees, they're like, oh, hang on, yeah, we'll come and join this ridiculous league and make you guys strong again. Wild.
The financial gap between the Premier League and the rest of the European leagues has been growing for years. We've known that. But the pandemic accelerated that at an alarming rate. Just weeks after the immediate threat of the Super League passed, a UEFA report showed that English clubs were responsible for a staggering 43% of global transfer activity in the summer of 2020. Fast forward to February of this year and another report was out. The current top flight teams in England have spent 6 times more than Serie A, 10 times more than La Liga clubs, and 12 times more than the Bundesliga.
Juventus and Real Madrid and Barcelona, they're facing a sort of much more precarious financial future.
Martin Ziegler points to this inequality as well.
The Premier League clubs, their overseas TV money has just soared despite the pandemic. They've had guarantee of same again for the domestic rights. So they're getting £10.5 billion over the next 3 years.
The combined revenue of all 20 Premier League clubs is projected to be around €6.1 billion in the 2021-22 season, by the way. Double that of their Spanish and German counterparts.
The losses suffered by the big clubs in Spain and Italy have been huge, and they haven't got that sort of future income. So they're looking at the Premier League clubs and thinking, my God, you know, how are we going to get back on their level?
This question has already shaped the recent history of European football, and you can bet it's going to shape its future too.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
There was one more person I wanted to speak to, someone a little closer to home. Pete Donaldson has always, well, worn his heart on his sleeve when it comes to football's brazen money-making schemes. Last October saw the ownership of his club, Newcastle United, change hands, sold by Mike Ashley to the Saudi Public Investment Fund. So it's fair to say Pete has been thinking a lot about football's relationship with money, its owners, and where fans can fit it in between. So we sat down together in the office canteen one morning.
I talk a good game on the ramble about my, you know, left-wing sensibilities, and my, you know, I like to think I play with a fairly straight bat on that. It's difficult, isn't it? Because, like, when the Premier League sort of came in, when the Champions League came in, sort of in the early mid-90s, everything changed. You know, it's not like I wasn't supporting a club that wasn't the richest in the league back in the day. You know, Sir John Hall had all the money in the world.
I've been to level seven at St. James's.
But, you know, we had a lot of money. You know, you don't assemble a team with, like, Les Fern and Alan Shearer and Faustino Spree and David Ginola in the side if you're not really, really bloody minted. So we've been here before with Newcastle United. It was a rigged game to a certain extent when I first started watching Newcastle. So I'm not going to shy away from that. But, you know, I like to think I've done my time.
Was it easier to put out of your mind before? Like now you have to, like, as part of your job, you have to assess, you know, what's right for the game, if that's not a bit too cloying.
I mean, look, you go high up a billionaire's business, you'll find some pretty horrific decisions and stuff. But when you're looking at state-sponsored executions, that's a level I think we can all agree is a little bit too far. So it's difficult. It's awful. None of the Newcastle fans asked for it. They have no say in it. It's sad that the Premier League and the European super clubs have got to that situation where we have to do this. But, you know, that's life. You know, it's big boy school now.
But even if your owner's not that, you've always got to question the motives, because their motives will never be the same as yours.
Will
they? Yeah. And it's something, like, it's a discussion that I guess we've had a lot around Wimbledon recently. Because I don't want to be all pious about how my club's wonderful. My club is wonderful, but I don't want to be all pious about it. But I think an interesting thing, because we've had a really quite dreadful season. December when we've not won at all.
It looks, and teams around you are picking up points, and it's you'll probably go down.
Right, you don't need to rub it in. the fact is, when the team's doing badly on the pitch, you'll have this discussion at the bar and in message boards and stuff, and people are going, well, how far can we go with, like, a fan-run model? And, you know, if we're gonna not struggle in League One, we need to sell the club and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
We've got something, like, so precious
and so rare.
You know, the fact that we're in this new stadium, that the fans built with our own money, should be, like, really proof that it all works.
And what a story, you know, like, what a story for that
club. It's amazing amazing, and it is the proof that counts. I still think, as fans, like, not just Wimbledon fans, as football fans, we underrate ourselves on what we can do.
It can be a really, really beautiful thing, but when you're constantly sort of going, well, we're never going to, unless we have a better right back, unless you have this better right back or a couple of goals on the side, and that means sort of doing a deal with the devil, like, have a bit of goddamn self awareness, I suppose, and self respect, I suppose. You can't just, and I said this at the turn of the Newcastle takeover. Like, you don't, like, it's happened. You had no say in it. It's not an ideal situation. It sucks. It makes me fall out of love of my club a little bit. But you can be better, and you can sort of look to the positives of your club.
So what's next in store for the game we love, and how do we protect it in the immediate term? Rory Jennings certainly isn't hopeful.
When they rode back on it, they were forgiven. And I hope I'm wrong here. I really do. But I'm beginning to see the seeds of things. You know, the way that the Champions League has changed, for example.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we are going to get, via stealth, a sort of delivered by ninja. We don't realise it, but it's actually landing. A Super League under a different guise.
The so-called Swiss model of the Champions League will come into effect in 2024. All 36 teams in a single league, all guaranteed at least 10 games, with, at the time of recording, two places potentially left aside for teams with the best historical performance that have missed out on qualification. It all sounds eerily familiar. And as we heard in episode one, it is just another in a long line of concessions UEFA have made down the years to ward off the Super League, but without driving away the money pouring into the sport.
We've forgotten the reason why football exists sometimes. It's almost entirely driven by business. And I'm not naive enough to think it will never be, because it is the world we live in. It is a big industry. But why it was there, the kind of social importance of the game, the need for it to be competitive as possible, that will also help the business part as well, I would have thought. Because at the end of the day, you risk making the whole spectacle extremely dull. Arguably, it is in some ways, where you kind of have this repetition and almost guarantee of what's to come at the start of the season. It shouldn't be that predictable. And, you know, I think it was really telling that last season's semi-finalists of the Champions League were the two petrol clubs, Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, the oligarch, then on oligarch-owned club Chelsea, and Real Madrid. And that, I guess, isn't the image that UEFA or the people who look after football want, that this is the future of football.
But in the current climate, what UEFA wants doesn't matter. As more and more capital comes into football, it becomes harder to draw a line in the sand. Despite the current calm at Arsenal, for instance, Nick Ames isn't in any doubt that their owners, like their Premier League peers, will continue to keep their ears to the ground.
I don't think for one moment that if something like this came on the table again in a slightly doctored form that they felt might be more acceptable. I don't think for one moment that they wouldn't jump onto it, frankly, because I think last time they went the way the wind was blowing and this time they would do it as well.
Besides Juventus, all these clubs that we're talking about now are foreign-owned and owned.
What's happened in Serie A in recent years is indicative of a wider trend in European football.
Investment groups. Certainly, they want to make their money. That's part of the decision. It's fascinating to me how many investment groups have got involved in Italian football in the last sort of few years. American investment, not just at the top of the table, but going down it, which suggests belief in growth even within that context. When we talk about the money league, you can sort of talk about first, 10th, 20th. It's a bit abstract. But putting real numbers on it, the top teams in the money league, you're looking at revenues of more or less, in the last one, I think it was around 600 million euros, a bit more than. Juventus in 10th are on 400 million, right? So it's already a huge difference. You're talking about 50% difference in your revenues. Inter around 14th, 15th, somewhere around 300 million euros revenues. Milan just got back into the top 20, 200 million revenues. So you're talking a third of those clubs at the top. Now, some of that is cyclical. Milan hadn't been in the Champions League, so Milan's going to come back up some more or another in the Champions League. Of course, the most recent Money League numbers take in a year where you haven't had open stadiums with the pandemic, or you've had different situations in different countries. But those are the sorts of gaps we're talking about bridging. You know, literally one third the amount of revenue as clubs you're supposed to be competing with. So, of course, if someone comes along and says, no, you get to be part of this private club, and your revenues are going to be maybe not exactly on a par with these teams, but comparable to those teams going forward. If you're an investment group that bought Milan, I can't imagine why you wouldn't entertain that. I can't imagine why that wouldn't sound like an interesting prospect to you.
More than ever, the game needs stronger governance over and above the desires of these investment groups. For Tarek Panja, there's only one way of doing this.
I think UEFA and FIFA, they need to be broken down into constituent parts. UEFA, we're talking about Super League here, so let's stick with UEFA, is got these jobs that are in massive conflict with each other. So on one hand, it is the organiser of two of the world's most popular events, the Champions League and the European Championships, right? But the one that I think causes the most conflict, really, is the Champions League, because it's organising this best club competition. It wants the best teams in there, and it's selling TV rights to this hugely popular competition and sponsorship, trying to raise all this money. On the other hand, it's got this really important function as a governing body responsible for rules, regulations and governance. Now, the governing body and the event organising part of the business seem to be in conflict with each other, I think, because you're asking for your top actors sometimes to be slung out of the competition or to be punished or to have a bad relationship with them because you're going to rule against them. And I think that makes them a little bit kind of cautious, overly cautious when it comes to application of the rules. That tension can be taken away immediately if you just create separate companies, a governance unit that's got nothing to do with what's happening with the sales of the competition and organising this event. You know, these UEFA presidents, for example, they're all and FIFA presidents, they're elected by national governing bodies. There's an enormous amount of politics here. That should be taken out. There can't be politics when it comes to just rulemaking, right? And I think the public don't believe in what they're seeing. And once that happens, you have a level of distrust, and then, you know, you risk, the long-term risk is people could walk away from the game.
Moving forward, you know, some of the solutions would be definite salary caps, a proper hard enforcement of financial fair play in a proper way, not the loose, watered-down version that, you know, has been laughed off by the clubs that can afford to laugh at it, the entire situation you were trying to avoid. Solidarity payments, kill them and redistribute wealth more evenly and more expansively. Honestly, we could go on an endless list here, but there has to be the willpower and the spine from the people running the game. And not just in this country, I mean, you know, all the governing bodies and all the associations, to stop being self-serving entities, to stop trying to maximize all they can from the game in terms of money and profits.
In the UK, the initial recommendations of Tracy Crouch's fan-led review could go some way to achieving at least some of these aims. Kevin Miles, chief executive of the Football Supporters Association and who is on the review panel, walked us through it.
The key ones for us are the creation of the independent regulator, the statutory powers necessary to regulate the game, that it has a prudential approach towards the finances of the game, that it allows not just the punishment of wrongdoing, of breaking of the rules, but support for clubs who want to run a good business model, in order to encourage all clubs to become sustainable. We want to see the creation of that regulator operating a club licensing system where if you're for a club to get a license to play, it has to be in conformity with all the other requirements of the club license, which allows you to put into the license things that should be set in there, yeah, but things about like diversity, just the diversity requirements. But within those club licensing requirements will be the existence of a golden share at the club, which gives a supporters organisation, the people I referred to earlier. There will be a shadow board created where the owners and directors of the club have to report to a shadow board, a democratically appointed shadow board of fans, so they're held accountable. There's transparency information about what the business strategy of a club is going forward, that information has to be shared. They will have to have independent directors as well who can act as a check on the, you know, look after the interests of the club as a community asset rather than just as the money-making tool of an owner. You put all those things in together with the powers of the regulator to ensure that the wealth in football can be more fairly distributed. The report as a whole has enacted together would provide a lasting and permanent solution to some of the threats that exist to English football, caused effectively by greed.
But we've been here before, haven't we? What we're asking for is fundamental change. And you can bet that takes a lot longer to achieve than it does to knock up a new Super League logo in Microsoft Paint.
Well, I mean, Andy, you're talking to the dregs of the people you've interviewed over the past few weeks and months. Like, what have you taken from people's answers, responses, and how other people have kind of talked about this subject. Are you more depressed or more optimistic about how it's all going
to
go?
It's impossible for me not to be optimistic.
That's why I like you, Andy. That's why I love hanging out with you. It makes me happy.
Football is a long way down the rabbit hole. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But
there are a lot of rabbit holes, and you could escape out another one. Exactly. There could be a network of rabbit holes.
There's definitely a network of rabbit holes. We've been all the way across Europe, and I think that's it. I do think there has been a realisation that people can mobilise, that people can influence things, that fans can influence things. And I think because elite level European football is such big business, it's easy to feel helpless. It's easy to feel as if, you know, what you think is not important and it's just going to happen anyway. Well, I think it's been proved that that's not the case. Everyone has got a voice if they can find it.
Yeah.
And everyone finding their voice made a huge difference to this story. And, you know, maybe it's not quite the ending, but it's had a different denouement than it might have done if people hadn't stood up and said what they thought and done it quickly, decisively and eloquently.
Football fans need to remember that they can use bed sheets for other things other than my manager out. Write something else on the bed sheet. If you're going to ruin a bed sheet, make it bigger than football. Make it political.
Yeah, stick a stencil of Atem Ben Arfa with the Che Guevara hat on. That's the most important thing.
Thank you for listening to Back from the Brink on Football Ramble Presents. If you enjoyed the series, please leave us a review wherever you're listening and share your thoughts with us on our socials at Football Ramble.
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.